You're listening to Cindy's Voice, a podcast that aims to raise awareness and advocate for the enslaved in an effort to end sex trafficking and sexual exploitation. Together, we're a community that educates, equips, and empowers you to take action against modern-day slavery. Every episode, we bring you inspirational stories of survivors who have been through the ordeal of human trafficking and sexual assault. In addition, we interview key advocates in the anti-trafficking movement and have them share their comments on the detrimental effects of human trafficking in our society. Now, here is your host, Cindy.
Hello, welcome to Cindy's Voice podcast. I am your host, Cindy Rivero, and today with me we're going to have Windy, a former sex child trafficking leader survivor, and she actually founded a nonprofit that is dedicated to helping trafficking survivors in North Dakota. She's amazing, and she is with us right now just to share her story and to tell us a little bit about herself. Please welcome Windy. Hi, Windy. How are you today? Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure. Well, my name is Windy Lazanko, and I am what's known as a survivor leader in the fight against human trafficking. So that does mean that I am a survivor. I was trafficked at 13 years old. Had a lot of the vulnerabilities and red flags that we teach about in our awareness campaigns. This was back in the 80s, and there wasn't a lot. It was actually unknown and unheard of to talk about trafficking back then. So I'm really honored to be a part of the work of raising awareness and creating prevention. And also, too, one of the lanes, the main lane that I've been in for the last 10 years has been in recovery and crisis response to those who are being victimized through human trafficking. So I've been sharing my story really worldwide for the last 10 years. And now known as an expert in the field of fighting human trafficking, which is also, that just speaks to more than just my story, that I am not just a survivor, although that in and of itself is pretty wonderful. I'm also someone who has dedicated a lot of time and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears to be able to advocate for those that I advocate for. So, yeah.
And that's amazing, because people just think that an advocate is somebody who shares the story, and it's not as simple as just sharing your story. It gets a lot of stuff. There's triggers. Every time that you share your story, there's physical impact in your brain and your body. So it will be, this is good for the people to understand that just sharing stories, open your mouth, right?
Yeah. And, a lot of times here, I would have to say in the last 5 years, when I get up to do trainings or keynote speaking events or whatever it is, I very rarely now even share my story, because my work in fighting human trafficking is far more compelling than my story of victimization. Although it's an important story to hear, but the stories of those that I've served, the lessons that I've learned, the things that I've been unfortunately aware of, just how big of an issue human trafficking is in the world, and especially here in the United States, the corruption that is involved in, the illicit industry that exploits people for profit, and so I find that to be far more compelling than my story.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of, I found very hard to explain to people what human trafficking or sexual exploitation looks like because of that variety of the stories, you know, like there is common denominator
sure.
and a way of, you know, a modus operandi, but there's so many ways, like they explode you, they play with your minds and everything, that is so hard to spot, to point it out. And then we go to the other parties, like how do we prove it? How do we put this person in jail? How is your experience with working with, you know, victims and survivors? I don't like to call them victims, but
right.
survivors. How is your experience when you try to help them, you know, bringing those people to justice, to go forward? Do you actually suggest it to them? Do you come forward, or how it works?
Yeah, well, I will stand by someone that I'm walking, you know, their recovery out with, and no matter what choice that they make, whether it's to pursue justice or to not pursue justice, that is something that they have full control over as far as participating, right? Because the point of doing really good law enforcement training and education is to be able to put together cases with evidence and so forth in a way that it doesn't require survivor participation. But unfortunately, under federal law, especially those that are over 18, that's a critical part of getting the prosecution. So if they choose to, I will absolutely 100%, and I have supported several girls that I've worked with in testifying or not. And my role in all of this, yes, I absolutely want to see the traffickers and the buyers. Like, that's almost my secondary solid lane, is fighting demand. And so, you know, of course I want to see success in that area. But when I'm working with survivors, that's my priority. That's my focus. And I try to, you know, collaborate with other departments and organizations and so forth to get the full circle successful outcome that we can, which includes healing for the survivor, freedom for the survivor, and justice to be served through traffickers and buyers being dealt with.
And Wendy, how often does a victim wants to press charges to actually go forward about the whole process? Because on my experience, at least on this part of the country, that doesn't happen way too often.
It's gaining momentum, I think, because now there is a strong, solid survivor community that's able to provide community and encouragement and empowerment to survivors, and more survivors are speaking up and going and choosing to do that. But it's still not 100%, nor do I think it ever will be, right? Everybody's trauma is different. What somebody is ready to do in the midst of a trauma response is much different than what they're wanting and able to do after some healing. So a lot of these cases take a lot of time. You know, and so for me, I think the most important thing is making sure that the survivor is fully aware of the process, you know, and through the experience of others who have testified or gone that route, you know, what's to be expected if that's the choice. And I think the more you prepare and the more you empower, then they're, you know, they're able to make that choice. It's a very personal choice. Comes with a lot of safety risks.
I agree 100%. It's very complicated, definitely, to go forward and just report your trafficker to the authorities. There's a lot on the line. And what is the best way to offer that opportunity to survivors? When they first come to you and they ask you some help, I think there are like weight traumatizers, some other priorities. Like, is that something that you offer at the very beginning, or is it something that they need to start processing after a little while, after they feel comfortable, after you earn their trust? Can you walk us a little bit through this process, at least through your organization?
Well, in a perfect world, right, they would be allowed to get some healing and make that decision from a healthy place. But if law enforcement is involved, and if it's critical to move because there's other potential victims or whatever, and law enforcement gets in there, right, and just wants to question the person who's been victimized and start building their case, which is awesome, right? But when I train law enforcement, I try to encourage them when at all possible. And if, like, I always suggest giving the person, the survivor, 3 days. Like, can we not question? I think this should be across the board a best practice and protocol for all kinds of different victim situations, sexual assault, domestic violence. Give the person who's been victimized 3 days. That way they're able to come down out of that fight and flight response and out of that trauma. And then start asking those questions. I find the law enforcement investigators, whoever is going to have a better successful outcome, if they do it, if they honor what the person's been through. And that's not to say that somebody who questions a victim doesn't care what they've been through, right? Their job and number one concern is getting the bad guys. So I think that it's training, and trusting those, especially survivor leaders who are advocates, you know, trusting our voices enough to know what's best for a solid outcome.
Correct. And now that you mention about, you know, the trainees and the police officers and everything, why 3 days? Why 72 hours? Why are you advising those 72 hours? Why not 24? Why not 48? Why not a week? Why
72? Yeah. I mean, ideally, it should be longer than 3 days, but I get it. It's just something I have found through working with people in crisis, is those chemicals that are released during trauma, you know, any compounded trauma that might be affected, somebody, you know, it gives time for established relationship to take place. And when better relationship is developed, you have better cooperation through you know, being an advocate. And you're able to make sure that that person gets adequate sleep, is able to be hydrated, get some good protein in their system, all those things that a person needs, right? Because like I said earlier, you will make a far different decision after the initial trauma has leveled out, you know.
And especially some of those victims are tragic. They are private from school.
Yeah.
They are abused. Yeah. So they don't even they're not enough, you know, things that you're saying. Like, they are not enough to make decisions. So that's a very good point of view.
Right. Like, we're not going to know that, right? We're not going to know that until we spend time with that person, understand their situation. You know, when is the last time you've eaten? When is the last time you've had something to drink? You know, when's the last time you got a good solid sleep? I think those are all crisis responders questions that should be asked. And I think we need to meet the need of those that we want to not only serve, but hope to get information from, so that they can participate in an investigation, even if that's just supplying information to law enforcement.
That is so important and so truthful, Wendy. And now that we are talking about it, it comes to my mind a TV show that is called Homicide Hunter by Lieutenant Joe Kenda. It's super known, is super entertaining, and it's based on real life. And I'm bringing this because of what they teach in it, actually. It's about investigation. Well, in this case, it's about people who get murdered, and he gets to be called into the scene. So once they're murdered and minute one starts, you know, that's where the TV show, like, it's all about. And he highlights in several times through the whole, what, maybe 6-8 seasons, that the first 24 hours and 48 hours, between 24 hours and 40 years, are the most critical ones for them to gather information and actually solve their cases. So how police officers and investigators react when you tell them, give them 72 hours to these victims so they can regather themselves, and in that way you guys are going to get better results, they are going to cooperate more with you. How do they get that information? How do they receive this? Because basically you are telling them to do totally the opposite. They have been trained for I don't know how many years and how many generations of, you know, trainees.
Do you want an honest answer? Okay. So, I mean, I think you have two, maybe three lanes where, you know, you're going to have law enforcement who are absolutely almost have that advocate spirit in them. They're law enforcement, but they work really well with victims of crimes, especially assault victim, you know, violence level crimes, who almost naturally understand the dynamics of that. And just so I can make it clear, I'm not saying this 3-day procedure should be applied in every single situation. I'm saying the majority, but sometimes you got to do what you got to do, right? But if it's an option, and if it's, you know, taking time to switch, like you said, those learned behaviors in law enforcement, now that we're learning more about trauma and learning more about building successful cases, why not give it a try? But you do have, unfortunately, in law enforcement, with the corruption, because none of this can exist without high levels of corruption. You've got some people who don't want to see successful outcomes with victims healing and being provided services and law enforcement being trained on how to best get an arrest and get a conviction. you know, so it really speaks to me. And I think being involved in so many cases and being on the front lines like that, I'm able to discern, like, why is this person not putting the victim's needs first? And that helps me to understand what I'm dealing with. But that comes with a lot of time, a lot of experience, a lot of learning. And part of learning is mistakes, too. So.
Yeah, you're right. Like, we're all learning, and as well as the police officers and, you know, like, standards and everything, we're all starting to just understand what human trafficking is and try to learn how to approach victims and survivors in a better way, because they're already traumatized, they're already with anxiety, they're already, like, risking their lives just by being rescued or by asking to be rescued. So we need to work in a very special way. Cindy, are you willing to share a little bit about your story and your healing process for us to understand?
Sure. You know, I grew up in a home that was a one-parent family home. So I had a single mom. I had also experienced early childhood sexual abuse, which these are all the red flags I was speaking to, but now we train people to recognize. And I was able to look back on where I was, you know, between the critical ages of 12 to 14 years old and see, you know, that I had a lot of transition, a lot of vulnerabilities, and I started running away at a really early age. And we know now, because it's actually being looked at, the statistics on runaways, and it's almost as if those cookie cutter experiences that we learn from and hear about was my experience. And this, again, was back in the 80s, so the, you know, computer.
Right.
Yeah, I was 13 years old. And a peer, who I now understand was also a girl being exploited. I didn't know that at the time. That came through a lot of healing. Was actually given the job to recruit young girls, specifically runaways. I fit the perfect bill.
She was just waiting for you.
Yeah, because this girl actually in school, the whole entire time I had been in school, never once paid attention to me. Like, you know, I was a semi-popular, likable girl, but me and this other girl, our paths never crossed. We were on two different, you know, and looking back on it now too, I look at her and she was much more mature for her age. She dressed super mature for her age. We all knew she had an older boyfriend. She missed a lot of school. Like, I look back on that.
All the flags were super there.
Yep. Yep. And she came to me and said, hey, my mom's out of town. Do you want to stay the weekend at my house? My boyfriend's having a party. Do you want to go? And I was actually going to go home. Like, I was going to, you know, I'd show up for school like an hour here, an hour there, just to see my friends. And I was actually going to go home. But I wound up going with her
to...
It was curiosity. I think I was a little bit like, why are you talking to me? I was also kind of thinking like, maybe this is going to lead me to what I've been trying to run to, meaning a safe place, a family, you know, a home with friends and all those things that I was looking to find by running away. I thought, what if this is it and I don't go, you know, And so, you know, all those kid ideas, right? Like, total kid ideas. And again, think about it, back in those days, we were not looking for this at all. Like, so I went with her. Every single process that was involved, that is involved in most trafficking situations, was a part of my trafficking experience the first night. And so I won't get into details because I think people can Google my story and see, but, you know, remember specifically her and her boyfriend kind of arguing. And I think it's because we had spent enough time together from after school to the party to where she kind of liked me and she was kind of trying to protect me. Kind of saying like, no, you know, but don't do this to her. Like, I remember there being a lot of conflict and a lot of tension between the two of them. And at some point she told me to go into the bedroom, and I thought in my childlike brain that she was trying to protect me. Like, maybe there were drugs, that were coming, or, you know what I mean? Like, I thought, she's my friend. She's looking to protect me, but I also became her friend. So I was looking to protect her, and I happened to turn around because I was going to tell her to come into the bedroom with me. Mm-hmm. And I saw her and her boyfriend talking to this couple, and I saw the couple, I totally thought it was a drug deal. Like, I saw the couple hand him money, and I remember her looking at me like, you gotta get in the room, you know, like she didn't want me to get in trouble kind of look. And I did, and about, not even a minute later, the couple had walked in. And I, you know, I through my healing and through walking this out in my memory lots of times and speaking of it and sharing it, you know, it does put me back there. It does help me to see things I missed and all of that. But I really believe that that preconditioning of surviving childhood sexual abuse primed me. Like, I had no idea that I was going to a party to be raped by a couple who were going to pay to rape me.
And by a couple, you mean a male and a female, right?
Female, right?
A male and a female, yep. And they were married, and I would have to say, looking back, like, right, I thought they were old. I was 13, so I thought they were old, but now I look at it, and I would have to say they were in their 30s. So what happened was, when, as soon as I heard his voice and understood kind of like what was going to happen, they didn't have to tell me what was going to happen. They did nothing. I fully disassociated, like, because that had been a coping skill, right, through the sexual abuse as a child. And so when that happened, that's what happened. And the next memory that I have was waking up. I don't think I was drugged. I don't think anything like that happened. I truly believe that I had disassociated, and I'm very grateful that I did. the next memory that I have was being on the front yard or in the backyard. And the girl had, you know, given me an outfit to wear, and I had her boots on, and she was just thoroughly concerned that I not get throw up on her boots. That's what we're, so, you know, and I did wind up going home after that. I won't get into detail about what happened, you know, when I returned home, a completely shattered young person. It was very, very hard.
Wow, that's a lot to handle for a teenager. That's a lot to handle for an adult. So I can just imagine everything that passed through your mind. And what happened when you got home? Did you get to sit down and tell your mom what happened, or did you just keep it to yourself? What was in your mind? Was that your first and only time?
I did not. And a big part of the reason why I did not was because when I was young, being sexually abused, I tried to say something. I tried to say something many times. And my abuser at that point had really pretty much, there was an event that occurred. A very traumatic event that occurred, and it told me and instilled in me very, very deeply, not to tell. And
did your mother know the abuse? I'm just trying to highlight if it
yeah.
was a family person or not.
It was a family member. Right. Yeah. Okay. And this part of my story, I have talked about, like I talked about it when I was a young runaway and I would wind up in runaway homes. I knew that what I had experienced as a little girl was not okay. And I knew that it hurt me, not just physically, but emotionally and mentally. Like I knew. And so through all different kinds of events throughout my life, you know, but I had never. So what happened, this is another little rabbit trail, right, is we look at those who have been victimized and we wonder how they could wind up in 2, 3, 4, 5 trafficking situations. Like, right, a lot of people who have never been there go, didn't you learn the first time? like, but what they don't understand is if that person has not received healing, And they're not in a safe place, and they're not giving opportunities, and they're not, you know, healing really, and in a position to make better choices. They have, I describe it to the young people I work with when I tell my story. It's like you have this big red blinking light above your head that says, you can victimize me, you can exploit me, you can hurt me. You know, I've been victimized. I know how to behave. I know how to You know, it's really, really sad. And predators and people who are looking for vulnerable people hunt and smell and see, and they find us. So after my experience of being, I call it trafficked. I was paid for by this couple. They raped me. I never saw that girl again. I never went to another party. I actually left school. I never went back. I just really kind of gave up hope in there being good in the world. And I, through a series of other events, I was, through another girlfriend, she was not a part of my being trafficked and exploited past this. It was an innocent thing for her, I'm sure. But she took me around a community of people who, have no problem victimizing women, children, exploiting them. And there's a whole nother story to that, but that went on for much longer than just one time. And, I never talked about it. And again, that speaks to how people say, you know, I've heard it all. I've heard, she never said this happened to her before. Why is she saying it now? You know, I was fully ashamed, fully thought it was my fault, knew nobody would believe me, knew that there would be consequences for speaking out. But when I saw, two things happened that empowered me to start sharing my story. The first one was I saw Annie Lobear. I don't know if you know who she is. She is a survivor leader from Las Vegas. She runs a program called Hookers for Jesus. I saw her on TV and she was sharing her story. And that was the first time I had ever heard someone speak anything close to what I had experienced, even though our trafficking situations were totally different. She was trafficked by a pimp on the blade in Las Vegas. You know, I was trafficked in a whole different way. I knew she was speaking my language. I was like, oh my gosh, like, look at her. Yeah. But I still didn't do anything with that. I just was like, wow, I can heal. Wow. This doesn't have to be something I hide. You know, like, it was just so freeing in and of itself. And then I started working with at-risk youth in a community in Montana through a youth group. And I had all these girls coming forward, sharing their vulnerabilities and sharing their experiences and like coming to me and asking me if some of their choices were, you know, something they should do or not do. And I was like, these girls are being offered thousands of dollars for nude pictures online. Like, one of the girls was 11 years old and she was offered $12,000 for a photo. And this girl comes from a very poor family, has all those red flags, vulnerabilities. And some older guy was offering her $12,000 for a topless picture and $24,000 if she sent a picture of her kissing her best girlfriend.
Wow.
I knew there was no money attached to that. I knew kind of, even though up until this point, I was not completely aware of what was going on with the internet. And so I was like, no, it's not okay. I know that sounds like a lot of money, but you know, I tried to explain to her where those pictures would go and what it would do to her emotionally. And I got online looking for ways to help these girls build up their self-esteem, understand those things that make them vulnerable because of their at-risk behaviors, you know? And so all of a sudden, Shared Hope International, again, this was like 10 years ago, right? There was nothing. I'm so proud of where we've come as a movement.
Me too.
Because we do have so many people have worked so hard. It's so amazing. There's so much more to do, but we have done so much. We want to be seen as humans, healed, healthy, and whole. And we want those we serve to be seen as humans, healed, healthy, and whole. And you don't get that reading a book. Or, you know what I mean? Like, so telling our stories and being able to stand up and say, the fight is worth it. Look, I'm alive. I am alive. I should not be alive. I'm alive and I'm doing something powerful and something valuable with my life. Every single person out there being trafficked and exploited is worth the fight.
Our time is running up, so what we're going to do is we're going to do a second part. We're going to leave it here for now, but please continue to listen to part two. It's already on air and is following. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for joining us this week on Cindy's Voice. If you like what you're listening to, like our YouTube channel, Cindy's Voice Podcast, and give us a 5-star review. This means everything to us. Follow us on Instagram at Cindy V. Rivero to receive updates on our latest episode. See you in our next episode. Till then, have a great week.